I am so impressed with everyone who's here, the numbers of us, and also the gifts that I am seeing so many people bring. I'm so impressed with, I'm not sure, is it Rick Love or is it the Holy Spirit that has moved among us to bring us all together? And maybe I'm confusing Rick and the Holy Spirit a little bit, but it's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal. And so we should give Rick some applause for what he has done to bring us all together. I imagine that most all of us resonate strongly with David Gushee's challenge about military spending and the powerful military, industrial, and ideological complex. The military budget is approximately $800 billion, including the cost of two wars initiated by the U.S. government in Afghanistan and Iraq. The military budget is now so large, it's the majority of the discretionary part of the budget that could be cut. You understand I'm starting from David Gushee's talk. I'm really doing it further, really. To reduce the deficit without raising taxes while increasing the military budget would require cutting many teachers, unemployment payments, job stimulus programs, Pell Grants and college loans, food stamps, and programs for the poor, aid to hungry nations, and none of this would come close to plugging the hole in the budget so long as we don't cut the military budget. In fact, my bracelet from Sojourners, maybe some of you have it too, what would Jesus cut? Which is an evangelical question from an evangelical movement. Let me just show you, if I can, the Panetta budget. I'm going to walk over here. The odd thing is, I got this from the Project on Defense Alternatives, and it should go a little farther. But you see that in 1976 and 80, and so on, we had a buildup in the military budget during the Reagan period, and then the Cold War ended, and we moved into the Clinton period, where he balanced the budget by cutting the military budget some. Then the George W. Bush increased the military spending in the first decade, and it's coming down a little in the plans of the Obama administration. The plan in the sort of orangish rust color is the plan for reducing it in order to try to move toward balancing the budget. And this sort of greenish one down here is the sequestration commitment, which I think won't happen. But just so you can see how big the military budget built up again. And let me show you one more. The thing didn't continue, but I'll tell you about it. See, $800 billion at the end of World War II, 1945. This is, of course, in adjusted for inflation dollars, and how that cut way down. But then, it was the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and then the Reagan buildup again, and it was coming down during the Clinton years and balancing the budget. But what it doesn't show here, although the Project for Defense Alternatives has it, I couldn't get it into my PowerPoint, but it's up to, again, about the level of 1945, the $800 billion, the amazing military expenditure, just to support a little bit further what David Gushee has shown us. Military spending produces far fewer jobs than investing in things like education, environmental technology, and rebuilding bridges, because one soldier in Afghanistan costs about $1 million a year. The supplies are so difficult and so forth. But if you add the enormous cost of rehabilitating the wounded and those with PTSD and those who commit suicide and so forth, it gets even greater. But one teacher or construction worker costs only about $50,000 a year. So therefore, $1 million pays for one soldier in Afghanistan or pays for jobs for about 20 teachers or construction workers. If you want to produce jobs, you decrease the military budget, you invest in teachers and in rebuilding the infrastructure and so forth, and you get a lot more jobs out of that. So that supports what David was saying. But David said pacifism and just war theory alone are not empowering. To focus on them proves to be disempowering and ineffective. Every war in the last century, 20th century, that the president wanted initially got majority support for war in the polls. This is because about 16%, I've studied these, this is not just made up numbers, about 16% support the war out of deference to presidential authority. About 20% support the war because it's America versus them, you know, that other enemy country. And about 20% support it because of the alleged threat, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or the dominoes that are going to fall if Vietnam falls. The president makes his claim, people believe it, and they support it. The war becomes unpopular only after people start to see the pain and the deaths and the costs of the war and how it's not doing us much good. So just to say no to war, whether from pacifism or just war theory, is a losing argument. If that's the way you frame the argument, no to war, you're going to lose. You're going to have the polls be, do you support this war? And the majority is going to say yes initially at the time when you would want to stop it. What we have to have in order to stop the war is to have alternatives to the war. If war is not the answer, people say, then what is the answer? If we want majority support for a different action instead of a war, we have to help people identify an alternative. People have to sense empowerment to do something effective about the alleged threat. That's what just peacemaking theory is about, identifying the alternatives. Just peacemaking arose first in my own book, Just Peacemaking, out of study of the Sermon on the Mount and its transforming initiatives for peacemaking, and also Paul's letter to the Romans, and faithful to that, faithfulness to that. But David raised the question of effectiveness, so I'm focusing there. And it's effective to raise the question, what are the alternatives to war? That's what I just showed with the polls. When five polls asked if we should let the International Inspections Agency finish the inspections before we make the war, 2-1, we won, war lost. Or gave the alternative of first let the United Nations give its approval before you make the war, as President Bush had promised, but didn't do. Almost 2-1, we won those three polls. If you construct the alternative, you see, that realistically gives us the alternative. In my teaching, I have experienced again and again that when students understand the alternatives offered by just peacemaking, then they see what can be effective instead of making war. And that energizes them to take seriously the criteria of just war theory or pacifism, depending on which they are. It makes sense to say no to war when you see there's this other way to go, when you have the alternative. So what we have is an ethic now, just peacemaking, that generates these alternatives. And if you will teach just peacemaking in your churches, your church members will be much more interested in the criteria that are the traditional criteria, whether pacifism or just war theory on war. That's effective. Two just peacemaking practices are to support human rights and just and sustainable economic development. When Turkey was faced with the terrorism of the Kurdish PKK movement, 30,000 people died in that struggle. But then Turkey switched from militarily attacking the PKK terrorists to emphasizing human rights, participation in the parliament and economic development for Kurds. And the Kurds decided they're doing better with the government than with the terrorists, and the terrorist movement quit, basically, in Turkey. It's still alive in northern Iraq. But that was far more effective, ending the terrorism. How much more effective and empowering that is than the U.S. trying to end terrorism by making war on Iraq, or the Russians making war on Chernobyl. That's effectiveness. Which is more effective, ending the terrorism? Fourth, when an extremist Muslim terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, attacked the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on 9/11, the U.S. government could have asked, what is making those terrorists so angry, and taken action for human rights and economic development in the Middle East and Palestine. Instead, we were led in a violent response of revenge, announcing, one, a permanent war on Muslim terrorism, second, a war on Afghanistan, and third, a war on Iraq, three wars announced against Muslims in one presidential term. How effective was that in ending terrorism? Well, let's look at the data. Here they are. The year that the Iraq War started, there were 208 international terrorist attacks. After the war, the Iraq War, 3,000, and then 11,000 the next year, and then 14,000, then again 14,000. You see, the recruitment to terrorists multiplied enormously because of the anger of Muslims and Arabs against all this war against Muslims. That is hardly an effective way to decrease terrorism. It's just the reverse. Aren't the data clear? This is U.S. State Department counterterrorism data that I am giving you. Furthermore, the economic cost of those two wars was $2 or $3 trillion, depending on whether you do include the medical costs and the interest having to be paid on the indebtedness we incurred because of those wars. But doing it by human rights and by economic development is far less costly. Fortunately, when the rebellions of the Arab Spring broke forth in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, the U.S. government responded in more of a just peacemaking way. Our just peacemaking book says, do not try to impose democracy by making war. Instead, support human... Let me just clarify, by the way, the just peacemaking authors said sometimes the responsibility to protect or humanitarian intervention to stop, like, the massacre in Rwanda and so forth, sometimes that needs to happen. The just peacemaking authors included actually a majority of just war theorists and then also some pacifists. We don't agree on whether war is ever okay, but we do agree we've got to emphasize the practices that are effective in making peace. That's what it focuses on. So you can be a just war theorist or a pacifist. Either one, you're welcome as a supporter of just peacemaking. My own father was a captain in the Navy in World War II, and he loved just peacemaking theory. You understand? You can be either way. The U.S. government pressed the Egyptian army to support the nonviolent movement for human rights. That's nonviolent direct action and human rights, two of the just peacemaking practices. The U.S. government acted in Libya only with the urging of the League of Arab Nations and NATO and the United Nations and the just peacemaking practice. Have you got the just peacemaking practices distributed on your tables? Yeah, I'm referring to them, but I'm not going to talk about them really because I don't have time. But you see there the practices number 7 and 8 about international cooperation are crucial. Well, the U.S. government didn't do anything in Libya until there was the urging of the League of Arab Nations and the UN and NATO and so forth. As a result, Arabs and Muslims are not angry against the U.S. for imposing those revolutions on Tunisia and Egypt and Libya. Rather, they're grateful that Libyans are rallying in favor of the U.S. against that terrorism that happened. Six, one of the empowering practices of just peacemaking is just and sustainable economic development. But what David showed about the military budget is undermining our economic security. Seventh, the Obama administration is not perfect, I think, from a just peacemaking perspective, but in his Nobel Peace Award address, get this, he mentioned just war theory 3 times, but just peacemaking 4 times, and he advocated all 10 practices of just peacemaking. Now, the criterion for effectiveness I focus on is, do we get Christians to adopt an ethic in churches? I didn't think the president this fast would already adopt just peacemaking ethics, but he did, and he's been basically following it in his response to these revolutions among Arabs and Muslims. And with Iran, he's doing conflict resolution, trying it. Previous presidents didn't and failed. Jimmy Carter tried it with North Korea and got a result, but then the Bush administration stopped talking, and, of course, we got the problem we have. The 10th practice of just peacemaking is to encourage grassroots participation in groups, because you're not empowered and effective unless you're part of a group. So just 2 days ago, we have now organized with, as it says here, the Living Peace Church of the Church of the Brethren will be the supporter, and we have a movement now to have peacemaking groups in churches. You'll be hearing about this more. We got to empower Christians to be effective in working for peacemaking. And my time is up, so what can I do here? It's basic biblical truth. Isaiah says that when we do justice, the effect of delivering justice will be peace. It's effective to do justice. That's one of the just peacemaking practices. And Jesus weeps over Jerusalem because of not knowing the practices that make for peace, and he says there, you're going to get destroyed, which of course happened. 6 times Jesus prophesied that, and it happened. So finally, I want to come back to say just peacemaking is about faithfulness to Jesus' way, but I've been speaking about effectiveness because that's the issue that David really put before us. I want to point out that there are actually 4 books on just peacemaking. My initial book, Just Peacemaking, Transforming Initiative. Then there is the book, which is for sale over here, that the 30 scholars from different denominations have produced. It's already in the 3rd edition. It's really spreading. It's over there to be purchased, and it lays the whole thing out. And now we've produced the Interfaith Just Peacemaking with 10 Muslim and 10 Jewish and 10 Christian authors, and it will be out in paperback in November. Don't buy it now. It's $80, this one. But it's $30. It's $30 in paperback in November. So it's really spreading. There's also coming the book Formation for Life, and that's it. So thank you very much.